This week on Pirate Party Radio, credit card information revealed through search results, Google starts mapping your router MAC address to your house, and public admission of child porn tactic to corporate net censorship. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 26, for Thursday, April 29th, 2010.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last cause. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for all the links to the news stories mentioned during the show. We've got a bunch of incoming messages this week. First one's from Legion, and he writes, "The Swedish mainstream media is blatantly lying about ACTA. DN, one of the biggest newspapers, posted an article called Public ACTA, No File Sharers Will Be Shut Off. Speaking of the news, a lot of Swedish media didn't mention the fact that McAfee was the company that brought down a lot of the infrastructure in Sweden. They just said an antivirus company, or even Windows updates, but they have no problem citing McAfee's press releases about how terrorists will bring down the infrastructure. The irony kills me," and that's from Legion. Well, that's not terribly surprising from news outlets that want to, you know, sensationalize things, and they have corporate interests as well, because a lot of them are commercial, commercial radio stations, commercial television stations, and commercial newspapers that have to bow down to advertisers. So you have to watch where the money is going and where it's coming in from and who is sponsoring the news, and you can see what kind of slant they put on it. Mind Inversion writes regarding the Facebook changes that we were talking about last week. "I think my wife has actually stumbled onto a bit of genius tonight. After spending the last day or so talking about and showing all the Facebook privacy rollback, she's somewhat disheartened. She had a lot of longtime friends and extended family on Facebook, and while she doesn't want to lose contact with them, she felt she could not, in good conscience, continue to use Facebook as she had been. Then one of her relatives responded to one of the linked Facebook posts from last show by changing her name to something completely ludicrous. Now my wife is seriously considering doing the same thing, filling out her profile and data with ridiculous misinformation while continuing to use Facebook to communicate with her friends and family. She gets the service she has come to depend on, while her user data becomes hopefully marginally less useful. She's also discussing using a garbage Gmail account to sign up with this new silly pseudoname to further misdirect any spam. I don't know if you can use a Gmail account for Facebook. I'm not a subscriber." Yes, you can. "Of course, if one person does it, it's no big deal. If five people do it, still not a big deal. However, if the word gets out and people start using ridiculous names or their online avatar concepts, maybe those who run the sites, those who buy the info will start getting the point. We don't like what they're doing, and if you can't stop them with reason, perhaps you can bury them in bullshit. After all, as Sean Kennedy so often says, better live the lie you want than the lie they give you." That's from Mind Inversion. A lot of interesting points in there, especially about changing your name to something that is completely not your name. I know they used to ban that practice. I know somebody who has actually kicked off of Facebook because it wasn't a real name. And I've noticed a lot more fake names coming up on Facebook. that are somewhat even ridiculous names that nothing would, that it wouldn't pass by. But I think Facebook is so big that they can't go through all the names of people that are signing up anymore. But even to that point, you could give yourself a name that is a name that, you know, is a common person's name, but it's not your name. So you don't even have to give yourself ridiculous names. You just have to give yourself a name that is not yours. And I know that is probably against Facebook's end-user license agreement if you look through it. But, you know, if you refer to yourself by that name, I'm not sure if it's against their policies if it's, you know, not your, you know, your name on your birth certificate. I know a lot of people go by their nicknames. I know a couple of my friends on Facebook that go by not their given name, not their birth name, not their name on the birth certificate, but their actual nickname. But it's still a name. Like they use their middle name for their first name or something like that. So it's something to think about. And you can use a garbage Gmail account or a garbage email account that you've set up so that they can't trace it back to something that you use all the time. So you can define yourself in Facebook any way you want. They still do have your connections to other people in Facebook, all your friends and stuff. So they might be able to figure out who you are that way. But this is one more way if you are under the pressure to use Facebook as an everyday source of, you know, communication with other people. There are ways to, you know, scale down the threat of privacy. Sorry, a little bit of slip up there. Privacy, so people don't pirate your private information. How about that? And we've got one from Ryan, R-I-O-N, writes, Viacom sues YouTubers for copyright infringement while they steal YouTube content without permission. Change the name, run pre-roll ads around it, flash ads around it, and block link backs on their Spike.com site, along with other criminal comment. Mike Mozart of Jeepers Media on YouTube, a toy reviewer and recent YouTube advocate, has made a series of videos called Viacom Fails, in which he exposes copyright violations and the many sexually suggestive toys that they license. And I've got some links to those, and it's a little bit fluffy on the edges, but the main core of the content is completely relevant. It's the irony that they are commenting on YouTube stealing content from their media, while in turn they are taking YouTube posts from people who uploaded on YouTube, taking it without permission of the people who uploaded on YouTube, and put it on their own owned site called Spike.com. So very twist of irony there. So check out those links and what he has to say. And I've actually watched in the past this guy, like many years ago, some of his toy reviews. They're quite hilarious. He takes sexually inappropriate toys and, you know, kind of amuses them in kind of weird ways to show that they are not all what they seem to begin with. So some interesting stuff there. Thanks, Ryan. And this was sent in by LC. I recommend this add-on for all those who are seeking to protect their privacy on the internet. NoScript is a great sanitizer plugin for Mozilla-based browsers. I know a lot of you out there probably know about NoScript, and I use it as well on my Firefox, which is great for add-ons, so you can block what content that you don't want coming into your computer, because you are the one in control of what is coming onto your own computer. Don't let them have control of what is going onto your hard drive and your computer. You're in control of that. This is a free open source add-on that allows JavaScript, Java, and Flash and other plugins to be executed only by trusted websites of your choice, for example, your online bank, and provides the most powerful anti-cross-site protection available in a browser. When you install NoScript, JavaScript, Java, Flash, Silverlight, and possibly other executable contents are blocked by default. You'll be able to allow JavaScript, etc., executions from now on selectively on the sites you trust. You can allow a site to run scripts temporarily. If you're surfing randomly or permanently, when you visit the site often, you really trust it. So only allow the sites that you know about, that you trust, that you visit all the time. I mean, you can only give them so much trust because they may partner with third-party sites for advertising that's around it, but you can, you know, put AdBlock Plus as well for that as well, so it doesn't waste your bandwidth by downloading huge video ads, etc., only the ones that you want to see. Maybe there's some sites that have very, very relevant ads. Now, that's a better way to do things, is to say if you're going to a video game site and you want to see ads about new and upcoming video games. That's what trailers for movies are all about. Trailers are ads. Those are ads that people really want to see. People love watching movie trailers. So there are very applicable ads out there that people might want to see. But you can block all the rest. This means a NoScript learns from your own browser habits and tends to disappear in the background after a while, but it promptly comes back to save the day if you stumble upon a malicious web page. So it's not just sites that you visit, it's sites that you might accidentally visit by clicking on something you didn't mean to, or if somebody sent you a link in, you know, a social media network such as IRC or Facebook or any of those sites, and you click on it and blocked. And then you go, whoa, this doesn't look quite right. And you can go away and continue on your merry way without, you know, being infected or being exposed to things that you don't want to see. And he's provided a short link on how it works. And I'm going to link that in the Pirate Party radio forums as well, so you can take a look on how it works and you can decide whether to use it or not. He says, thanks for all your hard work, for all the hard work, LC. Thank you for that email. And if you'd like to contact me or ask a question or leave a comment on any of the news stories that I'm talking about, you can just head over to the Pirate Party Radio site at piratepartyradio.com and just type in the feedback form what you want to say to me. So in pirate news, privacy news from the U.S., Blippi begins recovery from credit card incident sent in by Fat Ninja. When we first covered the story of credit card details from Blippi appearing on Google, we noted that the startup was likely to be just as shocked about the discovery as everyone else. According to Blippi co-founder and CEO Ashvin Kumar, shock isn't the right word, as he listed embarrassment as the overall initial reaction. As soon as Blippi received word that the sensitive information was on Google, they reacted by reaching out to the search behemoth and asking that the index pages be removed. Google quickly responded and the links removed. That issue led to the credit card details being exposed was actually a flaw discovered when Blippi was in beta. However, while it was fixed on Blippi's website, there was never a request made to have those URLs removed from Google. If anything, one thing that has been perfectly clear by Blippi in the wake of the incident is that there are no excuses. This is clear from the message in a follow-up blog post by the company where they stated that they're sorry, but note that this is a very serious issue and simply apologizing is not enough. The post explains in detail several issues, including the incorrect assumption that all raw data a site collects is harmless. When the issue in February was corrected, Blippi did not know that the personal data exposed was indexed by Google. This missed observation led to the issues last week when it reared its ugly head again, served as an eye-opening experience. In the end, Blippi went to Google and asked that they remove all the indexed pages, some 20,000 in all, after a fifth card was discovered online. The reason was to prevent any future accidental disclosure. While we're pleased that the sensitive data is no longer accessible via Google, it is important to acknowledge that there was a period of nearly 3 months during which this data was publicly accessible. To this end, our team looked at all the data published on our service during that time period in an effort to identify the extent which information may be accessible to the public via a Google. So this is this very interesting story about how we should be able to protect ourselves from the sites that are, you know, a little lax in the security, but how we're still able to function as a consumer on the internet, because people are using their credit cards directly on websites such as Blippi or other websites to buy merchandise. Now, how are we supposed to protect ourselves when we're entering in information such as our credit card information that could be exposed potentially through Google indexing? Well, how? Really, how are we supposed to do that? We could hide behind another company such as PayPal, but then again, we're still trusting PayPal to not reveal our information. Anything could happen on these websites. Now, there's some responsibility on behalf of Blippi to, one, protect the information that is given to them by consumers, and two, to turn off indexing by Google. If you've got a website, only let it index the portions of the website that you want it to index. You can say to not spider this portion of my website, just spider my public pages, not the deep links within the pages, just the surface ones. And Google obviously did the right things. It took down the webs, took down the pages that were asked by Blippi, because Blippi is any website is allowed to do that. Ask Google to take down, you know, subdomains or the whole website off of Google. Of course, they should in turn protect their website by asking them not to spider. But who can we trust with our private information on the internet? Now, I know there's solutions out there like one-time credit card usage. So that is one solution. But further to that, how are we supposed to do that if anybody, if some people don't have access to these one-time credit card off credit cards that you can enter in the information once and the credit card is disposed of? That's a great solution because your information is only exposed, well, your credit card information is only exposed once. And I believe in this case, there name and address and some other information was also exposed. So they've still got that information and exposes what kind of purchases that you're making on the internet. If somebody types in your name and they get a list of all the purchases that you've made on the internet. Some of these, you know, if you have nothing to hide, then there's no problems at all. So you shouldn't be going to sites that you're embarrassed about. Well, people do that. People go to sites that they don't want their job to find out, the government to find out, their friends and family to find out, that are perfectly legal, but embarrassing and potentially damaging to their reputation as, you know, a normal everyday citizen. And maybe they'll get fired from work. Maybe not for that specific thing, but they'll find an excuse. There's always little whim laws that they can introduce at work or you know, you could be ostracized by your community for something that is completely legal and really is nobody's business. So how do you keep your business to yourself while still being a functional person in society and not having to go into the woods and live in a hut in the woods where you don't come in contact with everyone else? Suggestions, please give them in so I can spread the word on how to keep your privacy when you do not trust the companies out there that are asking for your personal information. You can use P.O. boxes as well. And maybe use a fake name, but, you know, there's limitations on legalities of using false information. Privacy news from the U.S. Cyber Privacy Act, not specific enough, opens door to abuse. So this is very related to the privacy that I was just talking about there. Sent it by Mind Inversion. No one likes having their personal information posted online by somebody else. Nope. And a new bill introduced by the House Representative Thaddeus McCotter aims to give users a way to send DMCA-like takedowns in order to get it removed. This bill suffers from some vague language that seemingly opens the door for abuse by those looking to take down criticism instead. And there's a very interesting story later on about taking down criticisms with abusive laws. The bill is HR 5108, also known as Cyber Privacy Act. The premise seems innocuous enough. It would allow individuals to ask websites to take down their personal information, and if they don't, the FTC could get involved with potential fines. The devil, as usual, is in the details, or in this case, the lack thereof. The bill's brief description leaves the open possibility that users could be sending takedowns en masse, either as a massive coordinated troll or simply out of their own frustration in an attempt to target criticisms on topics they don't like. In a somewhat extreme but possible situation described by the Tech Liberation Front, a group of trolls might start posting a bunch of personal information and then try to overwhelm a site with takedown requests simply because they don't like the site hosting such a discussion in the first place. Heck, people could post their own information and then send takedown requests later about it. The opportunities for abuse are endless. The Bureau of National Affairs Tech Law blog has another perspective on the Cyber Privacy Act, noting the bill's language only specifies websites that contain personal information, not necessarily ones that made info publicly available. The bill makes no distinction between publicly available information that provided during a commercial interaction either. Additionally, it makes no exception for sites that should display some level of personal information. Two examples provided are sex offender databases and WHOIS records on domain names. The upside is, as tech law points out, that there are virtually no supporters for this bill. People reading the text can barely figure out what it's supposed to target, and it's unlikely that a bill would make its way all through the system without major clarification. At least let's hope not. Besides, a number of websites will already remove your personal information if you just ask nicely. A law enacting a takedown system seems like overkill. Well, there's some very good ideas in this bill. Seemingly, say, a website has your personal information in the form of a credit card purchase, and you don't want them to keep that information online, your name and address and personal information, forever and ever in case their logs get exposed or maybe their site gets sold to a third-party company. You could buy something from this company and then issue them to remove your personal data from their databases. Very good to be able to do that. But like they say, this is way too broadly painted, and they need to reduce down the language that is used in the bill so you can't have frivolous takedowns of information just for alternate purposes to just, like they say, troll websites. Privacy news from Germany. Google Street View logs Wi-Fi networks and MAC addresses. Sent by Nephilim. Google's roving Street View spy cam may blur your face, but it's got your number. The Street View service is under fire in Germany for scanning private wide area LAN networks, the recording users' unique MAC media access control addresses as the car trundles along. Germany's Federal Commissioner for Data Protection, Peter Schaar, says he's horrified by the discovery. I'm appalled. I call upon Google to delete previously unlawful collected personal data on wireless networks immediately and stop the rides for Street View, according to German broadcaster ARD. Spooks have long desired the ability to cross-reference the MAC address of a user's connection with their real identity and virtual identity, such as their Gmail or Facebook account. Other companies have logged broadcasting WLAN networks and published the information. By contrast, Google has not published the WLAN map or Street View in Germany. Google hopes to launch the service by the end of the year. But Google's uniquely cavalier approach to privacy and its potentially ability to cross-reference the information raises additional concerns. Google CEO Eric Schmidt recently said internet users shouldn't worry about privacy unless they have something to hide. And when there's nowhere left to hide, the article ends. Now, really, let's get down to the crux of why this is a problem. I don't know how Germans' attitude towards privacy, but obviously there is some concern there. Everybody has concern about privacy. Now, is the outrage because it's Google doing this, or because they're associating with Street View and then, therefore, the addresses on the house? And as far as I know, there's tons of public Wi-Fi mapping sites out there. There's tons of them that you can even contribute to as you're walking down the street or driving down the street. It's collecting Wi-Fi data based on your GPS location. You can submit it to the websites and you can look. There's tons of them. Just do a search. And what are people's opinion on public information that anybody can retrieve themselves by being indexed and made easier to access? Like, is the problem that it's too easy to access? That Google's making it easier to access because these websites have existed for 5 or 10 years, as far as I know, being able to pinpoint somebody's address to a point on a map and their MAC address and therefore their IP address. And you can associate this with torrent downloads. You can see all the IP addresses and MAC addresses on torrent downloads and be able to associate that through the mapping network, if it's on a Wi-Fi, with where they're located. Because, say, not in a downtown core where there's apartment buildings and you can stand in one spot and there's like 20 Wi-Fi networks. They don't have to be open. That's the other thing. Or is it the consumer's responsibility to keep their Wi-Fi networks to themselves? Because this is public information. Where is the line Where's the point of privacy broken down in terms of accessibility to the information? It seems to be a sliding scale. This information is public. There's no disputing this fact. You can walk down the street right now with your handheld cell phone that has Wi-Fi on it and map your whole neighborhood. You'll be able to find out everybody in your neighborhood, pretty much where they live according to their IP address and MAC address, and be able to associate it with a house. Now, is the problem because this is too big? Is it the same kind of situation where you take a phone book and it's on pieces of paper and you can't do reverse lookups based on the phone number, but somebody scans that into the internet, and now you can do a reverse lookup on a phone number, somebody phones you, you can find out their address, their name, just by their caller ID. And I suppose that this opens the door to some be able to track down somebody that you only know with a MAC address on the internet or an IP address. Are we all going to have to rotate out our MAC address and IP address daily, or all go through proxy service such as Tor to now hide ourselves? Maybe not a bad idea. Maybe it's not a bad idea to do that. But is it our responsibility as a consumers? I would say yes, it is a responsibility as a consumers. And this is the part of educating the public of what can happen out there to your information. Because this is public information, you're broadcasting your information outside of your house to the people on the streets. You have to know where your Wi-Fi can leak out to. So this is very good information to know where your information is getting up to. But what do people out there think? What do you think of this, of indexing public information? It's out there. They're just making it easier to get. Anybody can walk down the street and take pictures of houses, put it up on the internet. Google has done that en masse. Anybody can walk down the street and get MAC addresses and IP addresses of Wi-Fi routers. Google has just done this en masse. Very interesting twist on it. Is where does the scale stop? Where does the sliding scale stop? It's been out there for 10 years, these IP addresses. Because Google's doing it, now it's a big deal. Very interesting. In copyright and patent news from the U.S., the FBI Department of Justice suit up 35 new agents and lawyers for intellectual property battle sent in by Mind Inversion. The FBI and Department of Justice said they were going to go hard after intellectual property crimes this year, and so far they seem to be keeping their word, as today the agency's appointed 15 new assistant U.S. attorneys positions and 20 FBI special agents dedicated to fighting domestic and international IP crimes. The 50 new AUSAs will work closely with the Criminal Division Computer Crime and Intellectual Property Section to aggressively pursue high-tech crime, including computer crime and intellectual property offenses. The new positions will be located in California, District of Columbia, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Texas, Virginia, Washington, and the Department of Justice stated. The FBI details most difficult internet scams. The 20 FBI agents will be deployed specifically boost 4 geographic areas with intellectual property squads and increase investigative capacity in other locations around the country where intellectual property crimes are a particularly concern. The FBI said. The 4 squads will be located in New York, San Francisco, LA, and District of Columbia. The squads will allow for more focused efforts in particular hotspots and increased contact with coordination of our state and local law enforcement partners. The 20 new agents will join 31 agents already devoted to investigating intellectual property crime, the FBI stated. I'm going to skip down a bit. The Government Accountability Office noted that the broad range of IP-protected products are subjected to being counterfeited or pirated, from luxury goods and brand-name apparel to computer software and digital media to food and medicine. Evidence of counterfeiting in industries whose products have public health or safety components, such as auto and airline parts, electrical, health and beauty products, batteries, pharmaceuticals, and infant formula, presents a significant concern. The World Health Organization estimates that as much as 10% of medicines sold worldwide are believed to be counterfeit. Industries that rely on IP protection, including the aerospace, automotive, computer, pharmaceutical, semiconductor, motion picture, and recording industries, are estimated to have accounted for 26% of the annual gross domestic product growth rate during the period and about a 40% of U.S. exports of goods and services 2003 to 2004. Now, I can understand The interest in protecting the public from physically harmful products, ones that will do you bodily harm, such as the food and medicine and mechanical parts. If your car fails, you put on a bad part, you crash into something, and you go and investigate it, and it's some knockoff part that's not made up to standards, not tested, not approved by the government, so that you don't crash in your car. It's this so-called counterfeit goods, such as the software and the digital media, that are sometimes even made in the same factory, you know, after hours. They turn on the machine and, you know, pump out 20,000 more units and load them into the back of the truck and cart them off to the flea markets and black market. But it's just not sold through regular retail methods. Now, I have to question if these tactics can be left better up to corporations to educate the public about the dangers of buying counterfeit goods, rather than the government spending our money to protect corporate intellectual property. Now, what is the point of the government protecting the interests of the corporations? Other than, I guess, to keep them in the country and keep the money rolling in from taxes. So it's really the lobbying of these corporations and getting them to spend your and my money on protecting their own goods when a lot of their own goods are coming out of their own factories, such as, you know, like, what harm is it doing to the end consumer of, you know, Coach bags being real Coach bags just being sold through other markets. I read something recently about, you know, them locking down on people selling legitimately sold products in other markets and then being resold back into the U.S. At lower prices because a different market can withstand lower prices than the U.S. market, where people are making more money and have more disposable income. And they're trying to lock down the worldwide economy that way. Very interesting way of trying to lock things down. So I'm not entirely convinced that this is a necessity that the government needs to step in and spend our money protecting the corporations from intellectual property of digital information. It's just not money worth spending, I don't think. Free speech news from the U.S. DMCA abuse extends to Twitter posts. Sent in my mind inversion, Twitter can be a decent communication medium for some things. But let's face it, there's only so much can say in 140 characters. It's hard to believe that a user could infringe on somebody's copyright within such tight constraints. But somebody apparently thinks they can. Twitter has removed an updated post by the music writer who runs JP's blog, citing a DMCA takedown request from an unnamed sender. The situation once again highlights a potential for abuse through DMCA's takedown system and raises questions about how much service providers should push back against abuses. According to a post on JP's blog, JP received a message from Twitter with a URL to the tweet that was being removed, noting that the reason was because of a DMCA takedown notice. The tweet in question was a link to a blog post on his site posted April 20th. The blog described a leaked album by The National, a link to the Amazon page where the album could be pre-ordered, and two links to MP3s from the album, both of which were hosted elsewhere. Incidentally, the blog post with the leaks is still online, while his tweet about the blog post is now offline. And of course, the Streisand effect is now taking place. Even more attention has been drawn to the leaks thanks to the anonymous DMCA takedown sender, which is likely the music label behind The National. As noted by Tector, there are numerous questions here over whether DMCA takedown was even appropriate in this case. After all, the text of the tweet did not contain any infringing material. It read, "New post leaked The National, High Violet," with a link to JP's own blog. It's the Twitter equivalent of us at Ars getting a takedown notice for a link to JP's blog about the leaked album, which has links to the MP3s. Did anyone retweet JP's tweet, and if so, did those get taken down too? How far can a copyright holder go down the linking rabbit hole before it becomes too ridiculous even for them? So this is a perfect example of abuse of the legal system to curtail unpopular speech by just throwing DMCA notices to everything that they don't like to hear and seeing what sticks. So he did not write anything or expose anything that is in a copyright infringement. He just talked about it. So they are shutting down free speech on the internet by issuing these DMCA notices. That they're able to, without intervention, and of course the ISPs are not going to stand up to it because they are not ready to fight for somebody's Twitter post. They do not care. So they're curtailing the free speech of people using government legal intrusion upon sites to take down unpopular speech. Nothing in the speech was infringing on copyright. It was pointing to somebody else's blog and pointing to something that was not hosted on Twitter. How did it get shut down? How were they able to take down something that they just don't like hearing? And of course, it's the onus is upon the person whose Twitter post was taken down to file a counter and a DMCA counter notice. And that takes time and possibly exposes them to legal implications if they were wrong and if they're found in a court of law to be liable for it, and if it does infringe on copyright. And really, it should be, the onus should be on the copyright holder to prove in a court that this is infringement, and not just to send down a piece of paper and get things taken down that they just don't like hearing. And the populace is going to be too scared to be able to fight against these large companies with huge lawyer arsenals. And that's what they rely on, is that people are too frightened to go up against them. Privacy news from the U.S. Senators to Facebook, quit sharing users' info. Yes, it's getting into the government as well. Which it should. Senate by Mind Inversion. Three Democrat senators today asked the Federal Trade Commission to take a look at Facebook's controversial new information sharing policies, arguing that the massively popular social network overstepped its bounds when it began sharing user data with other websites. We've asked the FTC to promulgate some rules, said Senator Chuck Schumer. The New York Democrats said the lines between public and private are blurring as cyberspace develops, but he said of Facebook's new information sharing policy, you know a violation when you see one, and this is one of those. Information on private matters, such as sexual orientation intended by Facebook users to be shared only among friends, might now find a wider audience, said Senator Al Franken and Michael Bennett at Capitol Hill press conference. So With Schumer, Franken said Facebook has changed its privacy rules in midstream. The tools Facebook is providing users to opt out of the information sharing programs are needlessly complicated and hard to figure out. Yes, they are. I do agree. They're very buried. The senators contended, I could go into how you opt out, but we only have so much time, Franken said. Yeah, the EF had to make videos on how helped people opt out. It shouldn't be that hard. It should be one button, opt out, but there's several steps. Facebook should change the rules so users have to proactively opt into the information sharing program, the senator said. Schumer said he learned about the new rules from his daughter, who is in law school. The senator said he's noticed no difference on his own Facebook page, which he assures reporters is very boring. I can attest to that, deadpan Franken, who made his living as a comedian before he entered the Senate. For purpose of comparison, you can check out Franken's Facebook page here, and it gives a link to a Facebook page. It's not his personal Facebook page, which is what's in question, so it's not a very good link, in fact. It's actually a fan page, the whole purpose of a fan page is for promotion and publicity, and is open to the public completely, to anyone who wants to see it. So they didn't link to Al Franken's actual personal Facebook page. But that's just a side note. Yeah, it is a bit unfair that in the beginning, Facebook says, we will not share your personal information to anyone. And then halfway through, they say, oh, wait, we're going to share your personal information with everyone. And we're going to make it hard for you to find out how to stop the sharing of information with everyone. And people are going to have to make how-to blog posts on how to get out of sharing your personal information. It should be an opt-in, but of course that doesn't work for them. That's not going to work for them because nobody would opt in to want to share their personal information. Would you go out of your way to share your personal information? Well, maybe you would. Maybe you would want to share your personal information. Maybe there's incentives. Facebook has got hundreds of millions of people to share their personal information. but for the purposes of sharing it with their friends. So if they can make people share their personal information with friends, somehow they should be able to come up with an incentive to get people to share their personal information with advertisers. And if they can't come up with a way to do that, the way to not do it is to do it through legalese and tricking people. It's not the way to do it, and bury the options deep in the settings of Facebook. That's not the way to do it. Free culture news from the U.S. Fair use generates trillions in the U.S. alone, sent in by Mind Inversion. From when pressing Congress to ratchet up the legal screws on infringers, copyright holders are fond of touting apocalyptic reports of how piracy is destroying their industries and the U.S. economy. But strengthening the nation's intellectual property laws isn't just a matter of cracking down ever harder on limiting the limitations and giving increasing powers to rights holders. Fair use and other limitations on copyright themselves generate significant economic activity. $4.7 trillion in 2007. Now, I'm going to do a side note here. The $4.7 trillion number is not based solely on fair use items. It is companies that engage in using fair use items within their day-to-day activity. If fair use was taken away, $4.7 trillion wouldn't be taken away, so they're hyping this on the other side as well. I continue. The Computer and Communications Industry Association, which counts Google and Microsoft among its members, today rolled out a report of the value of fair use, one that tries to answer the question, what contribution is made to our economy by industries that depend on the limitations to copyright protection when engaged in commerce? The method is similar to that used to several prominent piracy studies. In this case, the fair use industries are divided into core and non-core companies, depending on how important fair use is to their very existence. Economic activity and payroll numbers can then be crunched from this data, offering a rebuttal to any view of fair use that sees it as a mere afterthought in copyright law, one good for protecting YouTube parodies, but not much more. So they're saying that, yes, there are industries that rely heavily on fair use items, and I tend to agree. Take, for instance, the media companies. Themselves, when they quote books, print pictures, or television news programs that run video clips, or radio shows that air audio clips, even this show, relies on the need for fair use in reporting stories from other publications. I read out stories from news articles. I play clips off of YouTube, short clips, and read short news articles to emphasize my point. I read something recently about the polarization of the understanding of fair use in schools as well, where either students are having a free-for-all up to the point of argued plagiarization, where they're just taking huge paragraphs and inserting it into their own report and pretty much just piecing together other people's words. Or on the other side, they're too scared to include any outside work, including footnotes for fear of lawsuits or fear of, you know, cracking down. So both extremes are bringing them failing grades for obvious reasons, because one person is not doing any original work and the other person is not citing any information from anywhere and not having any data to back themselves up because they're too scared to even quote anyone. So this is the age that we're living in, where the corporations have successfully lobbied the mind of the children that copyright is extended into fair use so far that they're too scared to even touch anything else. They're mere consumers and not users of data out there that they can build upon and learn from and make something new out of something that exists. Or the other way, where they've been bullying people so far into the ground that they can't even think that they can use it at all, so they just say, forget it. I'm not even going to pay attention to copyright. I can't understand it. I can't keep track of it. I don't know what's copyright or what's not. I'm just not going to pay attention to copyright at all and just do a free-for-all, which, you know, I can understand both extremes people going to, because it is hard to keep track of. People pay lawyers tens of millions of dollars in court to argue these matters. How is an average consumer supposed to understand it themselves? And that is the point of this whole thing, that there is need for fair use out there. And they're trying to, the corporations are trying to convince people that winning the hearts and minds, that there is no fair use, that there is no freedom of use of copyright material that you have heard in your lifetime, that was created in your lifetime, even past your lifetime. Life plus 90 in the U.S. That is not reasonable. And that is what the Pirate Party is fighting against. Copyright news from the UK. UK ISP finds loopholes in Digital Economy Act, sent in by Mind Inversion. And this is from AAISP in the UK, aaisp.net.uk. The Digital Economy Act 2010 places a number of requirements on internet service providers. I've also linked their rundown of the Digital Economy Act and how they think it applies and influences and will restrict people in the UK. So they've come up with several ideas on how to get around the wording in the Digital Economy Act. Some very interesting ones. In the event, it says, okay, several ideas come to mind. In the event of a copyright notice, making our customer not a subscriber by allowing them to quickly and easily to change who the subscriber is, but could they continue the service unchanged? So what they're saying is that, okay, a customer got a copyright takedown notice. We're supposed to kick them off the internet, but we're just going to change out who that subscriber is. Say it's the father, and they get the name associated with some copyright infringement. Okay, they change the name to somebody else in the household, and therefore that person is no longer on their service. But the service continues, and they can repeat that ad infinitum. In the event of a copyright notice, making our customer not a subscriber by making them a communications provider. We're prepared to peer with our customer, buying access to our customer's IP blocks via their ADSL line for 1 pence a month. This makes them, or 1 penny a month, that makes them a communications provider, not a subscriber. But as their customer is us, a communications provider, not a subscriber, they do not become an internet service provider, and so not themselves subject to most of the regulations. So they're saying the customer is acting as a peer to them and not a customer, which, you know, in some cases that makes sense. People serve things off of their computer all the time. Some people can set up an FTP server at their house so that their friends can grab files from them easily by just logging in. There's lots of different examples for things being hosted on a person's web page. They can set up an HTTP site for web pages. They can set up any kind of server at all. Any kind of request can be sent back. So they're saying we're a peer now. He's not a customer. We are exchanging information, and he's not a customer at our end. Also, in the event of a copyright notice, making our customer not a subscriber by giving them a choice of IP addresses, a change of IP. However, by offering a choice and allowing them to pick an IP, they have not been allocated an IP by us. That means their service is not an internet service, so they're not a subscriber. Next one, recording where a customer is a communications provider, which applies if they provide communications to anyone. I suspect many businesses and even homes could buy our service as a communications provider. Operating more than one retail arm, selling to customers and allowing customers to migrate freely with no charge between those retail arms, thus bypassing copyright notice counting and any blocking orders, so they make up 20 different arms of their own company, naming them different each one, different terms of service, and they can just move from one arm to the other. It goes on and on and on. It says, interesting point on the reseller side, we normally have to contract direct with our end users, but in some cases, we deal with a reseller, wholesale customer of ours. There's no way to tell from the IP address who that reseller is. It is purely a contractual arrangement. Granted, a lot of these suggestions are based on semantics and wordplay, but semantics are a large part of how the legal system operates. Also, the tongue-in-cheek name of the written language of legalese came about because of the need for legal documents to be written in such specific words. So they're playing on the fact that the lawyers and the people who are writing these laws are relying upon specific terms of the act to define what the arrangement is between an ISP and a customer. So if the ISP changes that relationship, that act no longer applies. Very clever. Of course, it will be tested in court against the the words of the act based against the intent of the act, and it's hard to say who would win out. But very clever, and it's nice to know that there's ISPs in the UK fighting back against the Digital Economy Act, seeing that it is completely unfair burden upon the ISP to take on the role of the corporation, the media corporations, to handle how copyright infringement is going on the internet, and telling the ISP, saying it's your problem now. You're paying for kicking these people off the internet. You're paying for keeping track of how many times this person has been warned, and you're the one going to lose customers because of our draconian corporate structure and how we do business. And we're trying to keep alive by legislating our company to stay alive. Now, this next story blew me away. I could not believe it. Copyright news from Sweden. IFPI's child porn strategy, set in by Platon, a member of the Romanian Pirate Party. Child pornography is great, the speaker at the podium declared enthusiastically. It's great because politicians understand child pornography. By playing that card, we can get them to act and start blocking sites. And once they have done that, we can get them to start blocking file-sharing sites. The venue was a seminar organized by the American Chamber of Commerce in Stockholm on May 27, 2007, under the title Sweden, a Safe Haven for Pirates. The speaker was John Schulter from the Danish Anti-Piracy Group, a lobby organization for the music and film industry associations like IFPI and others. I was there together with two other pirates. This is from Christian Engelstrom, a member of the Pirate Party. Pirate Party leader Rick Falkvinge and veteran internet activist Oscar Schwartz. Oscar wrote a column about the seminar in Computer Sweden just after it had happened. Rick blogged about it later, as so did I. One day we will have a giant filter that we will develop in close cooperation with the IFPI and the MPA. We will continuously monitor the child porn on the net to show the politician that filtering works. Child porn is an issue they understand, said Johan Schulter with a grin, his whole being radiating with pride and enthusiasm from the podium. And seen from the perspective of IFPI and the rest of the copyright lobby, he had of course had every reason to feel both proud and enthusiastic after the success that he had with the strategy in Denmark. Today, the file-sharing site The Pirate Bay is blocked by all major internet service providers in Denmark. The strategy explained by Mr. Schuler worked like clockwork. Start with child porn, which everybody agrees is revolting, and find some politicians who want to appear like they're doing something. Never mind that the blocking is such ridiculously easy to circumvent in less than 10 seconds. The purpose at this stage is to only get the politicians and that the general public to accept the principle that censorship in the form of filters is okay. Once that principle has been established, it is easy to extend to other areas such as illegal file sharing, and once censorship of the internet has been accepted in principle, they can start looking at ways to make it more technically difficult to circumvent. In Sweden, the copyright lobby tried the exact same tactics a couple months ago after this seminar where Johan Schulter had been speaking. In July 2007, the Swedish police was planning to add the Pirate Bay to the Swedish list of alleged child pornography sites that are blocked by most major Swedish ISPs. The police made no attempt whatsoever at contacting anyone from the Pirate Bay, which they of course should have done if they actually found any links to illegal pictures of sexual child abuse. The plan was just to censor the site, and at the same time create a guilt by association link between file sharing and child porn. In the Swedish case, the plan backfired when the updated censorship list leaked before it was put into effect. An uproar in the blogosphere, the Swedish police was eventually forced to back down from the claim that they had found illegal child abuse pictures or had any other legal basis for censoring the file-sharing site. Unlike in Denmark, the Pirate Bay is not censored in Sweden today. But the copyright lobby never gives up. If they're unable to get what they want on national level, they will try through the EU and vice versa. The big film and record companies want censorship of the net, and they are perfectly willing to cynically use child porn as an excuse to get it. All they needed was a politician who were prepared to do their bidding, without spending too much effort on checking facts or reflecting on the wisdom of introducing censorship in the net. Unfortunately, they found One and newly appointed Swedish EU Commissioner Cecilia Malmström. In March 2010, she presented an EU directive to introduce filtering on the net, exactly along the lines that Johan Schulter was advocating in his speech in the seminar in 2007. I assume that the Commissioner Malmström's motives were honorable and that she genuinely believes she is doing something good that will prevent sexual child abuse. But sweeping a problem under the carpet or hiding it behind filters can never be the proper solution. If there actually are sites distributing pictures of child sexual abuse openly in the net, the site should be shut down and the people behind them should be put in prison after a proper trial. But Cecilia Malmström's internet censorship directive will have no effect on all sexual child abuse in the world. All she will have achieved, if she is successful with its directive, will be able to legitimize the principle of internet censorship in Europe, just like the copyright lobby wanted her to. It would be very sad if she succeeds. Amazing write-up. Thank you very much to Christian Engelstrom from the Pirate Party in Europe. We've always suspected the strategy of corporate tactics, but we've never been able to quote them publicly, anybody from media corporations who express it so plainly as that guy did in 2007. I don't remember hearing about this, but maybe it wasn't brought to the forefront on major websites. It took the Pirate Party to be able to expose this. The magic key to information control is to mention child porn, and then you work your way in from there, obviously. This news should be spread far and wide to every political realm to warn them of the dangers of voting through everything that passes across their desk, chanting the Protect the Children mantra. And it works so very well around the world. Anytime child porn is brought up, nobody is going to vote against it, because of the stigma that they will be associated with supporting child porn. All you have to do anytime some bill comes up is to forward them this story, this exact story, with the quote from a lawyer from the music industry on how they are using these child porn laws to enact their own ends to censor the internet from things that they don't like that goes against their corporate strategies. This is perfect. Keep this in your bookmarks. Net neutrality news from the US and China. Another ISP caught hijacking Firefox toolbar results sent by MindInversion. Earlier this month, we reported how Windstream Communications has started hijacking users' Firefox Google toolbar results, redirecting users to Windstream's ad-laden search portal instead of normal Google results. Windstream quickly fixed the issue after users complained and issued a statement insisting the hijack wasn't intentional. Ooh, that's a hard pill to swallow, Windstream, when you redirect them to a site filled with ads from you. However, Windstream never explained what occurred technically, because that'd be impossible. And every indication that they were tinkering with newer deep packet inspection technology that goes well beyond the now common practice of DNS redirection advertising. Slashknot now directs our attention to the thread in Mozillazine forums about a user whose Hong Kong ISP is now redirecting traffic from data plugged into the Firefox location bar, which usually uses Google by default, but something the user, of course, should have control over. My preferred way to get to many sites is simply to type their name in the location bar and let Google I'm Feeling Lucky feature take me to the actual site. I realize this might not be the most conventional way to do it. Sure, I could have bookmarks, but it's the way that I like to do it. I also use KDE's Alt+F2 launcher to start programs. Today I noticed that this great feature of Firefox, combined with Google, of course, has stopped working, and has instead replaced an ad-laden search result from another website. I've confirmed that my keyword URL setting is all still pointing to Google, so this must have happened at the traffic level. Again, this behavior appears to be going beyond normal DNS redirection and X-domain behavior we've seen ISPs implementing. And it's at something entirely new. Users see these behaviors even when using alternative DNS servers. So much for Google helping out in that respect by opening up their own DNS servers. 8.8.8.8 and 8.8.4.4 if they're doing this at the DNS level. You can just point to other DNS servers, but this talks about doing it at a different level other than the DNS level, where ISPs are actively interfering with your data and giving you different search results and giving you a different website than the one you actually requested. And this is exactly how net neutrality can come into play to help you block what is going on by these ISPs. Granted, this is in China, where the rules are a little bit different, and they usually get away with whatever they want to do. But I can see this happening in the US, where there are no rules in place, where ISPs are not allowed to interfere with the communications on the internet, giving way to whatever they want. If you're requesting a website like Slashdot or whatever, or Google or Microsoft's website, this gives way to ISPs injecting ads that you can't get rid of. Well, unless you're using Adblock Plus or whatever, they can get away with showing you anything they want. By taking the information that is being redirected back from these websites and altering it and inserting their own information in. And maybe you have to pay a little extra to get rid of these ads from your ISP. Maybe they're setting up a tiered system where ads are all over the place, and the only way you can get rid of them is to pay off the ISP. Or maybe, on the other side, Google has to pay them off. Maybe Windstream was hoping that Google would pay them to get rid of the ads so that they could, have a free reign instead of, pandering to Yahoo, who has paid them, or Bing, who has paid them more money. So the person who doesn't pay the money gets the ads inserted. So something to watch out for on your own ISPs when you start seeing funny results from web pages from your own ISP that you'd never noticed before, or things are a little bit strange and changed. So keep your eyes open in the future for your ISP altering what you're asking for on a kind of a private agreement between you and the person you're asking it from, between you and Google, between you and Microsoft, between you and Yahoo, between you and any other website. You're requesting data from them to give to you, and all of a sudden some third party is manipulating this data. And I don't care if it's ads or changing words or censoring words or redirecting to another website. This is almost a legal contract, and almost maybe that's the method they should go around it, is that you're entering in a legal contract by who wants to get the legality involved in here, but maybe you have to circumvent this kind of thing, where you request something from some site and nobody else can mess with it. Whether it's somebody hijacking your browser, your ISP doing deep packet inspection and altering the bits before they get to you. In worldwide copyright news, piracy problems? Music industry grew in 13 markets in 2009, sent in by Mind Inversion. Here's a surprise, recording industry revenues actually grew in 13 major world markets in 2009. Australia, Mexico, South Korea, Sweden, UK, Brazil were all amongst the countries that saw revenue increases. And the global music business says this proves the need for tougher anti-piracy laws. South Korea and Sweden in particular saw striking returns in growth, said Global Recording Industry Group's IFPI. The name comes up again. Showing how an improved legal environment can help impact on legitimate music sales. And this might be true. The data, though, is ambiguous. Sweden did get a new law in 2009 that gave rights holders a court-mediated method for getting names of accused infringers. And the Pirate Bay admins went on trial. But both of those tactics have been unusable in the U.S. for years. Remember the Grokster case and all those P2P lawsuits against individuals. So why did the U.S. account for the majority of the worldwide recording industry losses in 2009? Even as Sweden's record industry grew. It can't just be the improved legal environment in Sweden. And how do you explain the case in Australia? This is the country where a federal judge recently issued a 200-page opinion on which he ruled that the ISPs have no responsibility even to act on warning letters from rights holders, much less any responsibility to disconnect users from the internet. Yet revenue is up. Mexico isn't cracking down hard on P2P users, yet revenue is up. The industry's preferred legal solution continues to be graduated response in ending an internet connection, ending in an internet disconnection. But a quick look at IFPI's data shows no compelling reason to adopt such a draconian punishment as the final step in the process. In South Korea, the first country in the world to implement a three strikes law that disconnects for file sharers, 30,000 infringement warnings were sent last year, but not a single South Korean has been disconnected. yet revenue is up. Several ISPs in the UK were forwarded infringing letters to subscribers in 2009, but none were disconnecting users, even though the recently passed Digital Economy Bill doesn't allow for such disconnections for at least another year, yet revenue is up. And if an IFPI doesn't list France as a country where revenue is up, despite the fact that France has passed Europe's toughest internet disconnection law last year. In fact, a recent French study found a total of internet piracy has actually increased in France since the law passed, though it migrated from P2P to HTTP streaming and one-click download sites. So what's been driving the growth? The legal environment may have some impact, but new business models are also making an impact. Sweden, for example, is the home of Spotify, a hugely popular European ad-supported music service. Even IFPI attributes the growth to a combination of legal changes and the launch of popular legitimate services. Seeing this sort of industry data appear year after year, we're left with two thoughts. First, innovation is crucial. Make it easier to use Hulu and Spotify, both of which are not available in Canada, might I add, where I am, than it is to download P2P versions of TV shows and music. Many pirates will go legit. Second, the industry has overreacted on three strikes, and it's not even necessary. Internet disconnections have stirred up powerful waves of discontent, and there's no clear correlation between such laws and industry revenue growth. Settling for a solution that would garner widespread support, such as the forwarding of warning letters and possible connection throttling or an appropriate small fine as the last step, would have gone a long way towards removing the mask of anonymity from file sharing. Plenty of reasonable people would have supported such limited targeted steps, reaching for less would have achieved more, etc., etc. It keeps going on. So their own numbers don't lie. They're saying money is up, revenue is up in countries that do not have any laws enacted to shut down file sharers or make ISP shut down file sharers. The money is up. How do they explain it? They don't. They just point to examples that show that, you know, shutting down people is working, even though they haven't shut down anyone. So kind of a mixed bag there. Very interesting results coming back from the companies themselves, saying that revenue is up in places that don't have any laws enacted. Now, Pirate Party news. Delayed, not dead. This is from Pirate Party Australia. The move to postpone mandatory internet censorship legislation by the Labor government is testament to the unpopularity of the legislation. However, it no way represents a victory for the Open Internet campaign, with Senator Conroy's spokesperson maintaining that the government remains steadfast in their goal to push through the legislation that will create a state-sponsored internet censorship infrastructure, said Party Secretary Rodney Serkowski. He continued, this delay is a cynical move to minimize the effect that his terrible, misguided, and ill-conceived policy will have in the polls. We plan to continue to raise awareness and remind voters of the intent of the Labor Party government to pursue this policy. Politicians must understand that attempting to implement a censorship infrastructure of the nature proposed in a liberal democracy is electoral poison. So, keeping on top of it, the Australian Pirate Party for against internet censorship, because of the stories that I've read in today's Pirate Party News, Pirate Party Radio, of where it can lead to the implementation of a censorship type blocking system where they can keep adding and adding more and more things until anybody can get their way, blocking any website that they just don't feel is appropriate for them. So remember, if any of these stories has interested you, please check out your local Pirate Party to find out more, and so you can support them and what you can do to preserve your rights and freedoms. If you have news stories you'd like to hear in the show, questions or comments, just head over to thepirateparty.radio.com and submit them through the forum on the website. Thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.